Today is Tuesday, December 12th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, an attempted terror attack at a busy bus terminal in New York City.
Preliminary investigation at the scene indicates this male was wearing an improvised, low-tech explosive device attached to his body.
National security concerns are heightened as the holidays approach. The issue of sexual exploitation goes to the voters today in a closely watched election.
Why is it that they feel like they are able to sexually harass or abuse women?
Also ahead, nominations are in for a big awards ceremony honoring the best movies of the year. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, New York City was the target of an attempted terror attack Monday. A man detonated a pipe bomb strapped to his chest near the Port Authority bus terminal in New York City, wounding himself and three others. New York Police Commissioner James O'Neill identified the suspect, who's currently being treated for burns and wounds in a nearby hospital while under police custody.
Responding units found an injured 27-year-old male. We've identified him as Ikayed Ullah. A-K-A-Y-E-D-U-L-L-A-H. He had burns and wounds to his body. Preliminary investigation at the scene indicates this male was wearing an improvised, low-tech explosive device attached to his body.
In addition to a busy area for tourists, particularly around the holiday season, the Port Authority is a central transportation hub in New York, which connects most of the buses to neighboring states and cities. Joining us now from New York City is VOA correspondent Ramon Taylor. Ramon, you were on the scene earlier. Tell us what you saw and heard.
More than anything, you know, whether he succeeded or not, he managed to halt traffic in one of the busiest cities of the world. It took me about an hour and a half to get to the city today in what should have taken, on a normal day, about 25, 30 minutes. So you can just see how this affects every single New Yorker in one way or another. Just despite the fact that we're all relieved that nothing became, you know, worse than it was, it's just something that we all think about quite often.
What did you see once you finally did arrive?
You know, it was similar to the terror attack that killed eight people just less than 2 months ago, in the sense that within minutes, I mean, from what we heard and when I arrived on the scene, you know, a couple hours after the event took place, there was just scores of FBI, NYPD, the whole bomb squad bunch, I mean, helicopters overhead, just everything you would expect over a wide radius that along one of the busiest avenues in New York City. I mean, we're talking about a hub that connects Times Square, where 67 or about 64 million riders pass through every day, you know, between tourists and locals. So it's just it was a surreal scene where everyone was stopping along the police lines to where they could to see from a pretty far distance exactly what was happening in an otherwise deserted avenue, which is just a rare sight to see.
Was there any damage? Could you see any damage?
No. In fact, because everything was happening underground, we see the amount of sirens and red and blue lights of NYPD and the fire department, but there wasn't actually any damage as far as the naked eye could see above ground. You know, keeping in mind that this happened probably exactly below where we were standing over that three-block radius. This is a cross-section that every New Yorker, if you've lived here long enough, has traveled across this corridor from one avenue to another. So it's something that you can visualize, but you couldn't exactly see from above ground.
What's the reaction been with folks that you've seen or talked to?
You know, there's naturally just a little bit of wariness, knowing that this is the holiday season, that New Yorkers always feel that this is a city that is targeted. So there comes a natural sense of vigilance every single day, and every New Yorker will tell you that they're not going to stay home. They're going to get up and work and do their holiday shopping, and that's exactly what they told us. That said, you know, one lady told me that whenever she hears a noise that just sounds kind of out of the normal, she checks whether she needs to duck in that moment, and that's something that I think some of us, whether we are willing to admit it or not, is something that we think twice about sometimes. So we do put on a face of brave, you know, bravery, but there's always, you know, a tinge of what if in the back of our heads.
Well, thanks for that perspective. That's VOA correspondent Ramon Taylor in New York. Well, Monday's attack also brings up national security concerns as the holidays approach and tensions rise across the globe. Joining us for that part of the story, national security expert Jamil Jaffer. Jamil, what does this incident tell you about some of these concerns?
this is obviously a concerning attack, failed attack ultimately, but concerning from the perspective that it's yet another one of these homegrown ideologues who's trying to conduct a terrorist attack in the United States. It looks like he was, you know, influenced by ISIS, at least that's what we're hearing he's saying. I mean, it looks like he may have gotten some instructions on how to create this homemade, obviously failed explosive, potentially from ISIS sources, including the Inspire magazine, which, as you know, was the inspiration, or actually the guide more than an inspiration even, for the Boston Marathon bombers who built their pressure cooker bombs based on instructions provided in Inspire magazine. Very troubling events here in New York. Luckily, nobody hurt other than the bomber himself.
There has been heightened security all over the world from the recent statement by President Trump recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. And the Washington Post, at least, is reporting that a pro-Islamic State media group suggested that it was in response to the president's decision. What, if anything, does that say?
Well, look, I mean, obviously the president's decision is very controversial. Not clear whether this attack had any connection directly to that change in U.S. policy, but obviously very controversial decision, longstanding U.S. policy across Republican and Democratic administrations to not recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. So obviously this major shift in American policy, roundly criticized by the U.N., the Arab League, a number of our allies around the world, and actually not followed up by any other nation yet, all of whom have been asked to change recognition, none of whom have yet done so.
How concerned should we be that we may see more like this, given the heightened tensions in the Middle East and certainly anger by the Arab world?
Well, look, I mean, I think people react in different ways to a variety of events. Obviously, nobody should be conducting terrorist attacks in response to political or policy decisions. That being said, we have seen protests in the Middle East erupting since the decision. And, you know, folks who would conduct terrorist attacks in the United States have a lot of reasons they claim for their attacks, whether it's U.S. policy in the Middle East or our prior invasion of Iraq or the way we're treating detainees at Guantanamo Bay or U.S. policies generally or putting troops in the land of the holy mosques and, you know, the famous sort of bin Laden position on why he originally declared war against the United States, our effort to protect Saudi Arabia and Kuwait the first time around, but we put troops in the holy in Islam's holy lands that he should, you know, condemn the United States and attack them. So there are attack us, you know, and so there are a variety of reasons people give. This will almost certainly go on that list, but it's not a justification for these attacks. If you have a dispute with us on policy, you know, there are ways to express that. Killing innocent civilians is certainly not one of them.
The Trump administration issued a statement on this, talking about how important its immigration policies are, saying that, you know, the immigration policies that we've had in place are not good enough and not keeping America safe, and, you know, pretty much using this situation as one example why some of his changes need to be implemented. What do you say to that?
Well, look, you know, I think the administration's statement is interesting in the following regard. You know, right after the terrorist attacks a few weeks ago, also in New York, with the terrorists running down people in the bike lane, the administration issued a statement about immigration policies and talking about so-called chain migration. Of course, in that case, the visa recipient was not, in fact, a beneficiary of chain migration. He was the recipient of a diversity lottery visa, which also has been open to criticism, but didn't actually apply to that. Here, this individual apparently was, as we understand the reporting now, was a recipient of a family visa. But the idea somehow that there's a tie between our immigration policies and our family visa policies and terrorist attacks, it's hard to believe. Really, I think if the administration were focused on the national security aspect of this issue, the right thing to focus on is actually the pending expiration of critically important surveillance authorities, that is the so-called FISA Amendments Act or the 702 program, which expires in just a few weeks. Congress hasn't reauthorized that yet. It's critical that Congress does reauthorize it to protect our nation against the threat of terrorism as well as other national security threats. And so if the administration is focused on a set of policies about national security, that ought to be right at the top of the list, probably not immigration policies. And I suppose it's also worth saying that, you know, there are hundreds of thousands of immigrants in this country who have come here on whether it's diversity visa lottery program or the family visa program, none of whom have conducted terrorist attacks, or very few of whom, if any, you know, infinitesimally small percentage. And so the idea somehow that the solution to our terrorism problem is immigration policies seems to stretch at best.
All right, national security expert Jamil Jaffer. Russian President Vladimir Putin flew into Syria Monday and ordered a significant part of Moscow's military contingent there to start withdrawing Monday, declaring their work largely done. VOA's Victor Beatty asks David Lesh, history professor at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas, what this surprise visit and announcement mean.
Well, we've seen this before. Putin has announced the withdrawal, and there have been mostly a rotation of troops. So I guess in the strict sense of the term, he may be correct, but there's still a lot of action to be seen, I think, by Russian military in Syria. The province of Idlib is largely under opposition control, basically controlled by the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria, and there's no way the Syrian army could take that without significant help from not only Iranian and Hezbollah militias, but primarily Russian air power. So Russia is going to need to stay around for a while. But I think Putin, you know, very much is very eager to give the impression, particularly to various sinecures of power back in Moscow, that Russia is, in fact, withdrawing, particularly before the presidential election in 2018, where I think he really wants a one-sided popular mandate in order to enact the type of policies domestically, internationally that he wants to do. There's no question he's going to win. But I think he wants to clearly show to the Russian people and to these various sinecures in power in Russia that this is not, you know, the Soviet Union in Afghanistan in the 1980s. It's not the U.S. In Iraq after 2003. In other words, that they're not going to get bogged down in a quagmire. However, you know, that's easier said than done. As we know, you know, President George W. Bush proclaimed mission accomplished shortly after the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003, and of course, as we know, it was anything but. And I think the Russians, you know, while they are very eager to declare victory so that they can keep their two bases in Syria and then get out as out of town as soon as possible, they still have a lot of work to be done in there.
All right, David Lesh, history professor at Trinity University. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. The TV journalist in Somalia has been killed by a car bomb. The European Union tells Israel's prime minister Jerusalem must be the capital of two states. France awards climate grants to U.S.-based scientists. President Trump orders the revival of a U.S. manned space exploration program. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Republican Roy Moore and Democrat Doug Jones are making their final pushes ahead of the vote later today in a special Senate election in the state of Alabama. Jones said it would be disastrous to elect Moore after the former judge was accused of sexual misconduct with teenage girls. But at a rally Monday, Moore again denied all of the charges.
We're up to the neck in people that don't want change in Washington, D.C. They wanted to keep it the same, keep their power, keep their prestige, and keep their position. And we've got to change that.
Meanwhile, more than 50 female Democratic lawmakers in the U.S. House of Representatives called Monday for a congressional investigation into allegations by various women of sexual misconduct against President Trump, who has denied the accusations. Earlier Monday, four U.S. senators also called on Trump to resign over the allegations. Three women who last year accused Trump of making unwanted sexual advances renewed those allegations Monday, saying it was time for Congress to investigate claims against the president in the wake of dozens of other powerful American men being held accountable for their treatment of women.
The only reason I'm here today is because this offender is now the president of our country. I can promise you that I would much rather have gained public interest because of something great that I accomplished rather than something, in this case, quite negative that happened to me.
White House spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders, though, addressed the issue on Mondays with reporters.
The president has addressed these accusations directly and denied all of these allegations. And this took place long before he was elected to be president. And the people of this country had a decisive election supported President Trump, and we feel like these allegations have been answered through that process.
Joining us now for more on the ongoing conversation in the U.S., Vice President of Advocacy and Outreach with the National Center on Sexual Exploitation, Haley Halverson. What do you make of what's happening here in the country?
What I'm hoping can happen here is for really a broad cultural change to take place. We need a shift in how we address issues like sexual assaults and sexual harassment. You know, obviously in the 1950s, these things were not taken seriously at all. And I think a lot of people just assumed that now, because women can vote and we can have high-powered jobs, they just assumed that this was a minimal issue. But it's so clear from the, you know, Me Too movement that this is happening broadly, not only in Hollywood or on Capitol Hill, but even, you know, across America. There was one study survey put out by Wall Street Journal and NBC that said that 48% of women reported some experience of sexual harassment in their workplace. So we are really seeing that this is happening kind of top down, which I think means that we need to address it in a more serious way.
If people basically vote for a person that had those accusations against them, does that take something away from the women? Does that sort of invalidate? Would that inhibit other women maybe from coming out if they're not feeling like they're taken seriously?
I certainly hope not. it's a little bit difficult to say. I certainly hope that however the vote goes down, that women keep speaking up, because, you know, speaking truth to power is never easy, and whether that turns the tide in one election or another, it is only an incremental part in the long game that we need to play. So I certainly hope that no matter how these elections go, that women do keep speaking up.
And do you think that we really are seeing a shift in the conversation here as far as something that could have a lasting impact for changing the current climate with men of power in particular?
I think now is an opportunity to have lasting impact. You know, I've seen title after title and op-ed after op-ed saying, you know, we need to change the culture, we need to change the culture. But a lot of people aren't really taking a step closer and narrowing down on what is the issue here. Why is it that Harvey Weinstein, Roy Price, Mark Halperin, and all of these political individuals as well, why is it that they feel like they are able to sexually harass or abuse women? And ultimately, I think it comes down to an issue of male sexual entitlement. And that's something that is broadly heralded in our culture, from issues in the media. Obviously, so much in the entertainment industry is really focused on hypersexualizing women and normalizing the idea that males can just have access, sexual access to women at the drop of the hat whenever they want it. And so I think that we need to use this to have a robust cultural conversation about male sexual entitlement, and noting that everyone from legislatures on Capitol Hill to producers of our own entertainment need to take a step back and recognize that that's an issue that we need to address.
All right. We appreciate your perspective. Vice President of Advocacy and Outreach with the National Center on Sexual Exploitation, Haley Halverson. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
Hey there, this is Shauna Renee, the lady DJ and host of Soul Lounge. Every Sunday at 1400 UTC, I choose an artist that you and I love, and we break down their entire career while listening to their biggest hits. That's what we do here on the Soul Lounge. Once again, every Sunday, 1400 UTC, right here.
VOA's International Edition continues now as we turn to what's trending on social media. We're joined by Andrew Palchevsky. Andrew, what's the latest?
Well, Lori, one of the big benefits of social media is that it connects people around the world. It has made us communicate more. It's brought the world closer together. But is all of that necessarily a good thing? And that's what we're talking about today, because Chamath Palihapitiya used to be the vice president for user growth at Facebook, a pretty high up position in the company. By all accounts, he's very successful at that because Facebook now has more than 2 billion monthly active users. But despite that success at the world's largest social network, Palihapitiya is now speaking out against his former employer and other social networking
sites. Really?
Interesting. Yes, because during a Q&A at Stanford University's business school, he said that social media is ripping people apart and the social fabric of how society works.
Interesting.
Pretty strong words.
Yeah.
He goes on to say that the overuse of social media results in short-term dopamine-driven feedback loops where there's no civil discourse, no cooperation, just misinformation and mistruth. Now, this comes about a month after one of Facebook's co-founders, Sean Parker, talked about the negative impacts of social media on children's development and on society as a whole. So this is a very interesting trend that we're seeing. More and more social media pioneers speaking about not just its uses, but the danger of social media.
I guess there's good and bad to everything, and social media is included in that.
Absolutely. And that actually is a perfect segue for our other story that's trending today that has some good and bad elements to it.
What would that be?
Starts out as a very nice story. Keaton Jones is a young boy in Tennessee, and he made a video after he was bullied at school.
Mm-hmm.
He tearfully asked why he gets bullied, and he told people who are facing similar predicaments to stay strong.
I saw him. It was so sad.
It was a sad video, but you know what? It had a positive outcome because his inspiring message attracted 18 million views in just a couple days.
That's crazy.
And it attracted a lot of celebrities, a lot of sports stars inviting him to their games. Keaton Jones is from Tennessee, so Delanie Walker, who plays for the Tennessee Titans football team, invited Keaton and his family to their team's game on December 31st. Mark Ruffalo, the actor, invited Keaton and his family to be at his guests at the premiere of his new movie, Avengers Infinity War. And you have tons and tons of other celebrities, too many to name. Dozens from
this
sports
is a great
and entertainment.
Story.
It is a great story. It's nice to see everybody recognizing that bullying is not okay and giving this young boy support.
All right. We appreciate it, Andrew. Thanks so much. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association has announced its nominees for this year's Golden Globe Awards, with the Cold War fantasy romance The Shape of Water leading the nominees with 7. As VOA's David Byrd tells us, the nominees ran the gamut of performances and subject matter in what's regarded as a key predictor for the Oscars.
You may think that thing looks human. Stands on 2 legs, right? But we're created in the Lord's image. You don't think that's what the Lord looks like, do you?
This creature is intelligent, capable of language, of understanding emotions.
Guillermo del Toro's magical drama about a relationship between a river creature and a mute cleaning lady, The Shape of Water, gathered the most nominations with 7. Sally Hawkins was nominated for her performance along with Octavia Spencer and Richard Jenkins. Del Toro received a nomination for his directing.
This is a devastating security breach that was leaked out of the Pentagon.
The most highly classified documents of the war.
The Times has 7,000 pages detailing how the White House has been lying about the Vietnam War for 30 years.
The way they lied, those days have to be over.
Steven Spielberg's film about press freedom, The Post, got 6 nominations, including for Meryl Streep, Tom Hanks, and one for Spielberg. Others up for Best Film include the British World War II drama Dunkirk, the gay romance Call Me By Your Name, and the drama 3 Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
She signed a petition to stop our production of Avenue Q.
This is the play where the puppets drop the F-bombs.
Cool. It is not only not about that, but it's actually a play that you should see because it deals with the struggle of young adults being disillusioned with life.
Mm.
Feeling demoralized and defrauded by the false promises of tomorrow.
I can get all that here.
In the television category, HBO's Big Little Lies was nominated for Best Limited Series, as well as acting nominations for Nicole Kidman, Reese Witherspoon, Shailene Woodley, Alexander Skarsgård, and Laura Dern.
The world has changed. Society in Britain has changed.
You married a wild spirit. Trying to tame them is no use.
Two Netflix dramas were nominated for the Television Drama Awards, The Crown and Stranger Things, Hulu's The Handmaid's Tale, HBO's Game of Thrones, and NBC's This Is Us are also nominees. In the wake of the sexual assault scandal swirling in Hollywood, it was thought that female directors might be nominated for their work, including Wonder Woman director Patty Jenkins and Mudbound director Dee Reeves. However, no women were nominated for Best Director. In the Best Foreign Language Film category, Angelina Jolie's epic about the Khmer Rouge takeover of Cambodia, First They Killed My Father, was nominated. Alongside The Square from Sweden, Germany, and France, the winner at this year's Cannes Film Festival. Other nominees in that category included Chile's A Fantastic Woman, Loveless from Russia, and from Germany and France, In the Fade. The Golden Globes will be handed out January 7th in Hollywood. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today, but find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Through its binational commission with Nigeria, the U.S. hopes to find new areas of collaboration with regard to security cooperation, economic growth and development, and democracy and governance. In the northwest region of Nigeria, Boko Haram and ISIS West Africa have wrought a great deal of destruction on the Nigerian people, forcing more than 2 million to flee from their homes. Speaking in Nigeria, Deputy Secretary of State John Sullivan said, "I want to emphasize that the United States is Nigeria's partner in this fight. We are committed to helping the Nigerian people provide their own security." The U.S. has helped Nigeria modernize its military, but a military response alone in the Northeast cannot lead to sustained peace, said Deputy Secretary Sullivan. Nigeria's success requires improvements to the economy and governance off the battlefield, including credible investigations of human rights violations and mechanisms to hold those guilty accountable for their actions. To help those affected by Boko Haram rebuild their lives, Deputy Secretary Sullivan announced that the U.S. Agency for International Development will contribute an additional $45.5 million. The United States will continue to support food security and nutrition programs in Nigeria, including development programs focused on the northeastern states. Predictable economic policies and a transparent justice system are necessary to create an environment for growth and to attract businesses and investment to Nigeria. Sufficient energy resources are critical to fueling growth in Nigeria. Through the U.S. government's Power Africa initiative, the U.S. will help the Nigerian government serve the majority of Nigerians who currently lack access to electricity. In particular, Deputy Secretary Sullivan announced a $1.3 million project to address the shortage of gas available for gas-fired power plants under the Power Africa initiative. Finally, in addition to supporting the security and economic growth of Nigeria, the United States recognizes that good governance is necessary to sustain both over the long term. Fighting corruption and ensuring free and fair elections will make the government of Nigeria more accountable to its people and better equipped to secure its citizens and keep its economy growing. The United States looks forward to working with Nigeria to reach their shared security, development, and governance goals.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.